much. Thanks, Mark, for the invitation and the opportunity of this talk, and also the Perimeter Institute for the support of this visit. So I'm going to talk about strolling along gauge theory of echo, which is the title of a paper that I've done in collaboration with Dieter van den Bleeken, who is now in Turkey. So if the title doesn't make any sense, maybe I can replace this word by some more physical word, which is...
Does it work left and right?
Yes. Yeah. Ah.
Is that okay? You went back.
Yeah. I shouldn't use it. Okay, so I can use the word adiabatic motion, along gauge theory vacuum, which makes a bit more sense. So let me start by some motivation. So it's by now well known that gauge theories and manifold with boundaries exhibit interesting properties, essentially because actually, a set of boundary degrees of freedom appear in the theory. And this is because a subset of the gauge symmetries of the theory, which were non-physical, become physical, like global symmetries, because of the boundary. And these are called usually large gauge symmetries, but this can be a bit misleading because this also has another slightly different meaning in another context. So I use the word global gauge symmetries. So there is a lot of work on the study of these global gauge symmetries. And recently, we know that these are related to the IR effects in field theories. So Strominger and collaborators have shown that, the conservation laws associated to these large gauge symmetries lead to the Weinberg soft theorems and the memory effects and so on. But what I want to stress in this talk is that if you take a vacuum of the theory and act on it by these global gauge symmetries, then instead of a single vacuum, you have a space of vacua. And what we want to do is to study this space of vacua and see if there is a geometry defined on this space of vacua. And the next point is that we want to study if it is possible to move adiabatically on this space of vacua and to see what is the physical meaning of this motion. So this end, I have to introduce some technique which is called the Manton approximation, which is well known in the context of soliton physics, for example, which says that the low energy dynamics of the theory, of a given theory, is given by motion along the moduli space of minimal energy solutions of that theory. So I can give you some examples that maybe make the idea more clear. So if you consider this like Mexican hat potential, and if you have a particle moving on this potential, so if the energy of the particle is very small, this Manton approximation says that simply the particle moves just under zero modes, which are the blue line. So you can also have oscillations in the directions up the potential, but the amplitude is very small because the energy is very low. If you want a more physical example of this approximation, just consider this bobsleigh sport. So if the motion, if the velocity is low, the bobsleigh just moves on the bottom of this track. But this is an approximation, because when the track is just turning, then you have deviation from the bottom. So, yeah, but this is a very good approximation, because the velocity can be like 100 kilometers per hour, and the deviation is just like 1 meter. OK. So let me just make another, maybe more technical example, which is more related to what I'm going to discuss. So consider the moduli space of a magnetic monopole. The magnetic monopole has 4 parameters. 3 of them is just the location of the center of the monopole. And the 4th one is just a global phase of the matter field. So the Manton approximation says that the low energy dynamics of the theory, which can be in general very complicated, but the low energy is described by only the motion and this parameter space. So by making this, which means that make these parameters time dependent. I mean, the time enters the story only through these parameters. So if you make this x time dependent, it simply means that the monopole is moving on the space. And actually, really, it has some momentum, which is the charge corresponding to the motion. But if you make this global phase time dependent, so what you have is actually a dyon, which is a monopole, which is not only a magnetic monopole, but it has also electric charge. So the electric charge is the charge corresponding to motion along this 4th direction. OK, and in this sense, this, you might say that, I mean, what is the physical meaning of this global phase? Because it's just a gauge symmetry. But is it so annoying? OK.
We don't use the laser
part. Okay.
I'll see if I can be the boy from here.
Should I wait or I continue?
Try it now.
Yeah. Oh. Good. Was it cut or? Okay. Yes. So you might say that this is just a gauge symmetry. I mean, its transformation doesn't have any physical meaning. But no, if you move, I mean, the idea is that if you move along this direction, you have a very physical solution, which is a dyon, which is very not well known. So this is the idea that we want to use in our case, which is the moduli space. OK. So with this motivation in mind, the plan of my talk is following. I'll first introduce the classical Fourier-Yang-Mills theory in temporal gauge in a finite box. I mean, the boundaries are at finite radius. And then I study the space of vacua and the global gauge symmetry using the Manton approximation. And then I will introduce the geometry and the space of vacua. And also, I study the adiabatic motion and the space of vacua and give you the physical interpretation of this adiabatic motion. OK. So So this is the action of the Curie-Yang mills with a gauge group, with a group G. And this is the field equations. This is the covariant derivative. But I fixed the temporal gauge, which means that the time component of A is just zero. So from now on, when I write A, it's just the spatial components of the gauge. I mean, the time component is just zero. Then the equations of motion in this gauge divide into two parts. The first one is just a constraint equation. This is the Gauss equation. And the second one is the dynamical equation. And this dynamical equation is just the Euler-Lagrange equation derived from this Lagrangian, which has this natural form, T minus V. T being the kinetic energy and the potential energy, where these are given by this expression. OK. Although I have fixed the temporal gauge, I have a group of residual symmetries, gauge symmetries, which are given by just time-independent gauge transformation. So I write G dot A as a shorthand for this gauge transformation, G A G inverse plus G D G. OK. So note that a time-dependent gauge transformation is not a symmetry of this theory, because it would break this gauge fixing. I mean, and note that this transformation just acts on this A, which is just a spatial function. I denote this group by this curly G. Okay, so I have to introduce the notion of the configuration space, which is defined as the space of all field configurations on a constant time slice. So a time-dependent solution then on this configuration space corresponds to a curve on this space. So each point corresponds to a configuration. And then a curve corresponds to a time-dependent field, which might be a solution or not. And note that in this static gauge, the electric field is just A dot, which here corresponds to the tangent vector to the curve. So I also have the kinetic energy, which defines a norm on this tangent vector. And then by twisting this norm, I can define a metric in this configuration. So this configuration space contains all, I mean, can contain all the dynamics of this theory. But what's interesting for me that I'll introduce in the following slides is just the vacuum configuration space, which is a very small subset of this configuration. But I will use this metric. I mean, this metric will be induced on that subspace. OK. So what is a vacuum? A vacuum is a solution with absolute minimum energy. So note that the kinetic and potential energies are both positive, and therefore the vacuum should satisfy these two equations, A dot equals zero and F equals zero. And this implies that a vacuum is given by such form. So you can rewrite this as a gauge transformation of the trivial vacuum A bar O equals zero. So in this talk, I will denote each vacuum by A bar. And then A bar O is just the reference vacuum. So you can choose the reference vacuum to be zero, but you can choose an arbitrary reference vacuum. So all the computations can be done. I mean, I don't fix that choice. Just A bar O is just some given reference vacuum. So this is the set of all vacuum configurations of this theory. So note that because of this equation, my vacuum solutions are time independent, and therefore I can identify vacua with some configurations and some points on the configuration space. So this way I would call this the vacuum configuration space. But note that not all of these vacua are physically independent, because some of these gauge transformations might be just pure non-physical gauge transformations. And therefore, this vacuum configuration space will have a bundle structure. So I will have a set of physically distinct vacua, and on top of each one, I have a set of vacua, configurations which are physically identical to each other. So the space of vacua that I'm talking about is just a section of this bundle. Or if you think more mathematically, you can define it as the quotient. So I can introduce a coordinate system on this section, which I call the space of physical vacua and denote by V, really V. And then this will be, the moduli space of vacua. So now I'm going to study adiabatic motion on this space of vacua. So as I told you, the Mantonac approximation tells me that the time dependence can appear only through these parameters that specify the solution. So if I use this and I'm on my space of vacua, then it means that, remind that my vacua have this form, and then this Z is the coordinate system that I have chosen in my space of vacua. Then if I fix Z, I have one point in the space of vacua which corresponds to a field in the space. Then Z equals 0 just corresponds to the reference vacuum. And then motion and this space corresponds, implies that I have to introduce T only through this coordinate Z. In general, a solution has not this form, but this is the point that I mentioned. This is the Mantonac approximation. And this coordinate and the space of vacua corresponds to coordinates, a parametrization of my global gauge symmetry. Okay, so although each point in this configuration space is a vacuum, but the motion on this space is not a vacuum solution. It's a solution that has electric field. And I can compute the electric field, which is given by this form. Instantaneously, it has the form of an infinitesimal gauge transformation. But this gamma is time dependent. And this is A dot. But since this A has this specific form, I can just replace this covariant derivative at point Z with a covariant derivative at the reference point, and just put G and G inverse here. So this sigma is just G inverse G dot, which is an element of the algebra, gauge algebra. Okay. Then now, now I have to curve on this space of vacuum. I have to impose the equations of motion to see what are the constraints. So first I impose the Gauss constraint, EI A dot I equals zero. And then you can use the same trick. And what you find is that EO squared of sigma should be zero. So sigma, which generates the curve, should satisfy this Laplace equation. So therefore, the physical directions and the space of vacuum are generated by those gauge parameters who are in the kernel of this Laplace operator. And these are these form a subset of the gauge algebra. And you can just simply write the solutions to this equation. These are given by R to the L by LM spherical harmonics. And these TI are elements of this algebra. Note that we are considering the theory in a finite box. So I exclude those other solutions that diverge at the origin. OK, so somehow this is the first characterization of global gauge symmetry. Because, I mean, these sigmas are generate the symmetries at the reference vacuum. And this analysis tells me that sigma is, I mean, this direction in the space of vacua is physical if and only if sigma is an element of S. Remind that S is just the kernel of this. But I can give you also a second characterization of global gauge symmetries, which is somehow more geometrical. So note that using the metric defined on the configuration of space, I can define an inner product on my gauge algebra. This gamma 1, gamma 2 is defined as the metric on the variations generated by these gauge parameters. Now define the group of local gauge symmetries as those gauge symmetries that become one at the boundary. So at the level of algebra, this corresponds to G0, which are gauge parameters that vanish at the boundary. So now I can state the second characterization of global gauge symmetries, which is very interesting. So the statement is that the space of global gauge symmetries is the orthogonal complement of this algebra of local gauge symmetry with respect to the metric that I just defined. In other words, you can write G with gauge algebra as G0, which are the local gauge transformations, plus S, which are the harmonic gauge parameters that I mentioned. And these are orthogonal to each other. So just to show you how the computation works, let me just briefly tell you the proof of this. So just take an arbitrary element of this algebra of local gauge symmetries, gamma 0, and an arbitrary element of the gauge group, gauge algebra, D. Then the bracket is just defined in this way. And then I can just integrate by parts, write it as an integral, a volume integral of this Laplace of sigma plus a boundary integral. But this boundary integral vanishes because I have gamma 0, which is vanishing at the boundary. So it drops. And I find this one. So if sigma is an element of S, then this integral vanishes, and therefore this inner product vanishes, which means that sigma is also in the orthogonal to G0, which means that S is a subset of G0 orthogonal. And reversely, if sigma is orthogonal to gamma 0, so to any element of this local gauge algebra, then this is 0. And since this integral is 0 for any gamma 0, then this should be 0. And this implies that sigma is an element of S. So I just proved this. And this decomposition implies that for any given any element of the gauge algebra, I can uniquely decompose it into an element of S and an element of G0, which I denote by gamma S and gamma 0. But note that S does not form an algebra with respect to the usual bracket. So essentially, because the commutator of two harmonic functions is not a harmonic function. Okay, I mean, by harmonic function, it's not a function, it's algebra value. So the idea is to introduce a modified bracket which actually closes on this space S. And therefore, using that modified bracket, I can call this S this algebra of global gauge symmetry. So in order to do this, I have to introduce the third characterization of global gauge symmetries. So note that G0, the group of local gauge symmetries, is a normal subgroup of the gauge group. And therefore, you can define the quotient group G over G0. I call this S, capital S, curly S, and I call it the group of global gauge symmetries. And this, I mean, this group has some algebra. And the point is that the algebra of this group can be identified with the space S that I was talking about if I use the following modified bracket on this S. So it's very simple, just the modified bracket of sigma 1 and sigma 2 elements of this S is defined as the usual commutator, which is projected then to S using the projection that I just introduced in the last slide. Okay. So, and the third characterization of global gauge symmetries, so with this bracket I call this S the algebra of global gauge symmetries. And the third characterization of global gauge symmetries is that S is actually isomorphic to the gauge symmetries at the boundary. And the reason is, I mean, you can simply prove it using what's called the first isomorphism theorem, which says that if phi is a homomorphism from a group G to a group H, then the kernel of phi is a subgroup of G, and the normal subgroup of G, and the image of phi is a subgroup of H. And moreover, the quotient G over the kernel of phi is isomorphic to the image of phi. So let's use this theorem and the gauge group G, this one, and take phi to be just a restriction to the boundary. Then simply the kernel of phi is nothing but the group of local gauge symmetries because they vanish, they become identity at the boundary. And therefore, G over G naught, using this theorem, is just isomorphic to the image of G, image of phi, which is just the gauge algebra, gauge group of the boundary. Okay. So let me just mention about the inner product and the algebra of global gauge symmetries. So using this identification of S with the algebra of the boundary, one can naively define an inner product between two elements of S as the boundary integral of trace of sigma 1, sigma 2. But it turns out that the metric that we have defined, the inner product that we have defined on S is more non-trivial. I mean, recall that the inner product is given by this expression. And then if you integrate by part, then you have a volume integral proportional to Laplace of sigma, which is vanishing. And then you remain with this boundary integral. Okay. And then you see that in terms of this round bracket, this is just sigma 1, some operator d, sigma 2. And this operator d is at the boundary is nothing but the normal derivative to the boundary. But I can also extend this operator inside the bulk by requiring that the action of d on S is still in S. Okay, so then it will act like a linear operator on S. But this operator D can have some degeneracy. And if I put some degeneracy of this operator here, then the inner product will be zero. And I just want to say, what's the physical meaning of this? So consider an element of S, which is the degeneracy of this operator, D. Then it can be shown that, because D of sigma is 0, and sigma, by definition, solves this Laplace equation, you can show that these two equations imply that, indeed, the derivative, the covariant derivative at the reference point of sigma is 0. And this implies that this sigma doesn't generate any variation on the reference vacuum. It acts trivially. So I defined a group of isotropic gauge symmetries as those gauge transformations that, this is just A bar O. They act trivially on the reference vacuum. And associated to this group, I have an algebra, which I call K. And actually, this implies that the kernel of D, this operator D, is just the algebra of isotropic gauge symmetry. So using all these, I can now discuss the geometry and the space of vacua. Okay. So as I said, the moduli space of vacua is defined through the action of the global gauge symmetries on the reference vacuum, which I call V. Then by definition, it is a homogeneous space. And therefore, it's isomorphic to the quotient group, to the quotient S over K. This K is the isotropic gauge symmetries, which act trivially under reference vacuum. And then because S is already G over G naught, then you see that this space of vacua is isomorphic to the to a double quotient, G over G naught over K. So you can decompose the, this algebra of global gauge symmetries like this M plus K, where K is are those acting trivially, and M is actually isomorphic to the tangent space at the reference point. Okay, if I define a basis for M, I call this basis like lambda A underline. So now using these basis vectors, I can define the, I can give an explicit representation of this this physical vacuum. The way that I do it is just by exponential map of these basis vectors. I mean, I define this G of Z to be the exponential of lambda A underline ZA, the sum over the coordinates A. Okay. So now I want, now recall that for an adiabatic motion and this space of vacua, I have this relation for the electric field. And then I can put this into the Lagrangian. Note that because the magnetic field is zero, the Lagrangian just reduces to the kinetic term. And if I replace A dot by this expression here, I see that the Lagrangian is nothing but the inner product of this sigma z with itself. And since, as I said before, I mean, look at this sigma. So sigma is G inverse G dot. And G dot, I mean, since time appears only through Z, I can write the dot d by dt as z dot a d by z dot a partial a. And then you can write the Lagrangian in this way. Z dot a, z dot b, the inner product of ea and eb, where e is just g inverse dg. So here d is just the exterior derivative and this space of vacuum. And then I project to m because the other, I mean, projection to k leads to vanishing inner product. So this is, I mean, this is what's called the Maurer-Carton form, actually pulled back to V. So note that this is, first of all, F1 form because of this D. And also, this is algebra value. And then I can just write it in the basis like a square matrix, EA, A underline, DZA, lambda A underline. So this, recall that this lambda A is just a basis for M, for this M. And so the conclusion is that the Lagrangian is that of a free particle on the space of vacuum. With the metric, so just look at this one. So this Lagrangian is z dot a, z dot b, and then I can call this gab, the metric. So the metric is given by this form. And then in terms of the round brackets, you can write it like this. And then in components, you can write it as dab, and then these two, eaa, ebb. And this is just the way that if you write a metric in terms of the wheel bias, this is just what you find. And therefore, this E plays the role of the wheel bias on this space of vector. Then, since the Lagrangian is the Lagrangian of a free particle and this space of vacua with that metric, the solutions are nothing but the geodesics in this space. Actually, we were not able to classify all the solutions, but a large set of solutions are given by this exponential form. So exponential t, v, v is the velocity along the curve, t is time, and lambda a is just an element of the global gauge algebra. So this is a geodesic if this lambda a is an eigenvector of this operator t. I will not go into the details of this. And then, so this is a geodesic. And then this geodesic corresponds to a field in the spacetime. So what's the corresponding spacetime field? The magnetic field is zero, but the electric field is given by this form. So I will tell you in a few minutes what's the physical intuition about this electric field. Okay, so note that this space of vacua is a very symmetric space because it's actually defined through the action of symmetries. And then you can see that the metric is left invariant under this global gauge symmetry. And therefore, associated to each element of the algebra of global gauge symmetries, you can define a killing vector in this space, completely similar to the killing vectors that you define in spacetime. And the killing vector corresponding to element sigma of S is defined this way, where this EAA underline is the inverse of the wheel bind that I introduced before. Okay, and then associated to each killing vector, you can define conserved charge. Very simple in this way. But the point is that this, I mean, if you want, you can call it momentum or whatever. This charge is actually exactly the charge that people would define using the asymptotic symmetries. I mean, if you look at this expression, I mean, you can define an asymptotic charge associated to this asymptotic symmetry sigma in this way. So we recover those charges in our context using this completely different approach. Okay, so let me just conclude with some examples which essentially give me the interpretation of those adiabatic motions in the space of vacuum. So the example is just Maxwell theory. So here you don't have algebra. So the global gauge symmetries are given simply by these harmonic functions. So this is the so for each L and M I have a gauge transformation. This is the basis for my gauge algebra. And then you can see that this operator D that I was discussing is just a scaling operator. And so the isotropic symmetries are given by L equals zero mode. I mean, this is just a constant. And if you put L equals 0, this is just a constant. And this doesn't change the vacuum because essentially there is no global charge defined in vacuum. And the other directions which act non-trivially, which form M, are given by those with L greater than or equal to 1. And the wheel binds, E, are given simply by this, by LM, D is at LM. So for each choice of L and M, you have a direction on your space of vacuum. So it's infinite dimension. And then you can compute the metric. And it turns out the metric is flat because the theory is linear and simple. So you can just absorb these coefficients into DLM. And then the metric is just easy LM squared. But the interesting point here is that the electric field, I mean, the field strength associated with this adiabatic motion, the geodesics, and this space of vacua has some interesting interpretation. So the electric field is given by this, as you remember. Then here, these group elements are just one, so they drop. And you find that electric field is just minus gradient of some of sigma. And this is, and also the magnetic field is zero. But this is simply, and note that the sigma is just a solution to the Laplace equation. And this is nothing but a solution to the electrostatics problem. So the conclusion is that geodesics on the space of vacua correspond to source-free electrostatic solutions. So remind that I'm considering a finite box, let's say a sphere of radius r. Then this solution is just, if you want, you can think of it as the solution that is generated by putting some arbitrary surface charge on the boundary. So let me call it by, I don't know, f of x. I mean, this is the surface charge, which can be arbitrary. And then the electric field that is induced inside is what you find here. So this is the interpretation of the geodesics and the space of vacua. OK, so you can also consider the Young-Mills theory in the same situation. I mean, the global gauge symmetries are, again, similar, but you have this Ti here. Sorry, this is capital R. So these Ti's are just elements of algebra G. And then you can find the modified algebra in this space. And then it's just given by Fijk, which is the algebra of these, and the structure constants of this algebra. And then these are the Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. So this is the algebra. But actually, we were not able to study the metric in this case because it was too complicated. You can write formally the metric, but we don't know how to compute the curvature and so on. This is an open problem. But here again, the space-time field is similar to this case, electrostatic solutions, but this time dressed by some global gauge symmetries. OK, so let me just conclude by two points. First is the relation of this study to the memory effect. So just consider that. So I start with some. So assume that this is the space of vacuum V. I start by some vacuum, given vacuum, and then which corresponds to the vacuum inside the sphere. And then I turn on the electric field slowly, which in this picture corresponds to starting slowly moving on this space. And then again, I turn off this electric field. And then what I find is that I don't go back to the same point. I finish with another vacuum. So this is somehow the memory effect. You change the vacuum by this way. And another point that I want to mention is, so in this case, we considered, in this talk, we considered the finite R problem, but we think of this R as kind of IR regulator. But what happens if I send R to infinity? So you might say that, OK, the charges diverge. But note that the form of the charge is like this. So Q is like R times V, where V is the speed of the motion on this curve. And if I write the kinetic energy is like RV squared. So if I scale V like 1 over R, I mean, if I send R to infinity, then I send V to 0, like 1 over R. And this way, I find that the charges are 0. But then if I put this in the energy, I find that the energy is 0. So I have solutions with zero energy but finite charges. So in this way, I have soft modes in the sense that they have finite charges but zero energy. OK. So I'm done. Thank you very much.
So this operator D that just to make sure I understand it, what you do is you fix a value of sigma on the boundary, you use those as boundary conditions to solve a harmonic equation, and then you pick out the normal derivative. Is that right?
I mean, I don't fix any boundary condition, okay. And my gauge fields.
Yeah.
I mean, you didn't see any boundary condition here.
No, but
you're right. I mean, the global gauge symmetries are completely determined by their boundary values.
Mm-hmm.
If I fix a boundary value, then I can just solve the Laplace equation to extend it inside the ball.
Mm-hmm. And so is the difficulty in writing down the metric in the non-abelian case the difficulty in solving that?
No.
So the
point is that the metric, so I mentioned at some point that the metric is just defined, the inner product. Anyway, the inner product is on S, the global gauge algebra is given by boundary integrals. So you can define the metric completely using the boundary data. But the problem is these exponentials. I mean, you should use this. As I said, G of Z is like exponential ZA lambda A.
I see.
And then you have to compute some of these exponential powers.
So it's basically it's solving the geodesic equation that's difficult.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Not finding the metric.
Yeah. Yes. Also, I mean, even if you define, I mean, you can define the metric, but in order to compute curvature or something like that, because the space is infinite dimensional, you have to base over some components. I mean, we haven't tried so much, but maybe it's doable. Yeah. Sorry, I don't have a lot to say about that. But maybe we can discuss it. Yes.
You use the temporal gauge. Do you have any idea which part of the story holds true in other gauges? Or?
Right.
Yeah, good question. This
temporal gauge was very suitable for studying the vacua because if you remember when I solved the equations in the temporal gauge, I found that A dot equals zero, so which means that the A is time independent, and I could identify those solutions with elements of the configuration of space. But if I don't fix that, the story will be a bit more complicated. But after I talked with some people here, Aldo and Hendrik, so it seems that it's not very essential, but I don't know at the moment if I can really do everything in other gauges or even without fixing any gauge. Maybe it's possible, but I'm not sure. Yes.
When you construct the vacuum manifold, you quotient by your script K, right? Quotient.
Right.
Do we know that action is free? Because we know that
the action is not free because
there can be. There are fixed points in the vacuum manifold will have.
Yeah, exactly. This K is exactly saying that there are elements of the group that act trivially on the vacuum, on the reference vacuum. And actually, in the example of Maxwell, I just told you that this L equals zero is just the element that acts trivially, doesn't change the vacuum. Does this answer you?
If there are fixed points, then there would be, I imagine there are difficulties in defining the metric on the space.
Sorry, what do you mean by fixed point? I'm not sure if I understand.
If the action is not free, it means that that there are fixed points under the action of the group by which you're quotient.
That your quotient is not a manifold. I mean, it's how you define the case.
There will be points which are singularities
like
of the action.
Ah, I see. Yeah.
The right word.
It should be okay in this case. But isn't your group acting sort of transitively on the space? Such a way. I mean, isn't the space a copy of the group, basically, or not?
I think so, but
space of vacuum. So it's a copy of the group. So you're just taking a quotient of the group.
Yeah, I'm just taking a quotient of the group.
Because
yeah.
The usual way of doing canonical quantization of gauge theory is you do have fixed points for the action of the new quotient by the action of the gauge group. Mm-hmm. So, maybe
I have to think more about that.
It can happen in general, but I'm not sure I understood, but I think it won't happen in this case.
I'm sure it happens in this.
Are you sure it happens?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
This quotient in this case.
This is a special set of connections.
Subset.
So it's a subset of the space of connections on it. generically there are fixed points. I think that if you technically mathematicians restrict themselves to something called irreducible connections, and those are the ones for which the action is free. But they may not be the only ones that are, but the reducible ones are also interesting from the point of view of physics.
Okay, thank you.
I missed the introduction, so maybe you covered this, but are you imposing some boundary conditions on the fields?
No, I didn't impose any boundary condition. Because essentially we are considering a theory in a finite box, and then putting a specific boundary condition doesn't make so much sense, because I mean, why this choice of boundary condition? Why not anything else?
Normally you expect that the solutions of the equations of motion will be ill-defined if you don't. You have a time-like boundary. So you would expect that these solutions are ambiguous unless you impose boundary conditions.
But now that you ask this, I think at one step we have assumed that, I don't know how much that is important, but we have assumed that something like that the magnetic field is vanishing at the boundary, something like that.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, I think we have assumed
this on the physical field.
Okay. But right. But for example, in consider the Maxwell theory. So field of strength is gauge invariant. So if you fix such boundary condition, it doesn't impose any constraint on the gauge symmetry.
No, not the gauge, but it's a condition on the field.
Yeah, right. Yeah, maybe we have we need some minimal boundary condition.
Yeah, I'm not sure why they're minimal, but anyway.
It's a small class of configurations with the
Vandal. I think.
But isn't this meant to be a piece of a larger?
I really don't want to.
Feels to be vacuous. I mean, that's not quite self-consistent. I mean,
sorry, could you repeat?
Is it correct that you're restricting yourself only to configurations which are vacuous, or are you first setting up a theory which allows for arbitrary fields, and then looking at what is the vacuum sector of this?
Yeah. I look at the vacuum sector.
But first, you're setting up a complete theory.
Yes.
In the box, right?
Right.
So you could also talk about solutions.
Yeah, I could.
Solution. It may not be your interest here, but the theory should allow you, the setup that you've done should allow you to talk about more, you know, light propagating within the box.
Right, but I mean, the starting point was this Manton approximation that I mentioned, that, I mean, the low energy...
that's an approximation, but that's an approximation within a Fuller series.
Yeah, of course.
So I'm just asking, does that Fuller theory must involve some boundary conditions?
Right.
Some of them may be relevant to your...
Right, I see. But
collective coordinates or something, but the others are not, maybe. But there still must be some boundary condition.
Mm-hmm. But the impression that I have is that those waves that you talk about are like those oscillations along the vertical direction of the, I mean, the you remember the potential that I mentioned? Should we stop? So I think the waves that you talk about correspond to oscillation in this direction. So I'm not considering those because if you have limited amount of energy, the amplitude of those oscillations are very
small. But I'm just trying to. You're not assuming that those are physically impossible. You're just assuming, you're just saying those are not the ones of interest.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So I'm just asking, what is the larger theory? For example, suppose I wanted to study those oscillations. What boundary conditions would I need on the fields? It just seems to me if you don't say in advance what they are, you haven't really set up a consistent theory yet. So then it's a little questionable to look at a particular approximation within.
So I mean, in any theory, you have this space of vacuum. I mean, this is the minimal space that you can consider.
Yeah,
of course, if you could.
When you call them vacuum, you probably mean that they're the ground state of the.
Yeah, exactly.
Theory, but in order to talk about what is the ground state of the theory, first you need to say what is the theory. I suspect you implicitly have imposed some boundary conditions, like you said, magnetic field vanishes or substances.
Yeah. But, right. But I think, as I said, that's something like minimal boundary condition. I mean, it's not a. I mean, if you. It allows you to have many different solutions. It doesn't uniquely specify the solution. If you give me an initial problem.
Well, it should uniquely specify the solution up to gauge. So if you set initial data, so then you should be able to evolve it, and the solution should be unique up to gauge. No.
If I specify the boundary condition completely, yes. But maybe I don't want to do that because, for example, I can have. As I said, I can have some surface charges here, which can affect the physics inside. Maybe I have to think more about it.
If you have something inside a perfect conductor, you will produce surface charges. But nevertheless, it's a physically well-defined dynamics.
Let me think more about this.
Right, let's thank Khalid again.